Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Sally Elcordi, and you're listening to Public Advocate Radio. Please visit my blog, tinyurl.com/wakeup515. That's tinyurl.com/wakeup515. This is a blog dedicated to my bona fide concern about patients in New York City who are dying. Now, I have been reporting about this as reports are coming in from different health professionals, funeral directors, etc. And now I have a recording of Erin Marie Olzowski, a nurse who has come to New York to work in the hospitals during COVID-19. Another nurse has reported about what she has reported to her. Now she's reporting firsthand. I'm expecting this video to be taken down, which is why I am now going to play it for you. And I would love to interview her myself, but it's not necessary. This man has done a spectacular job, and she has been extremely forthcoming. So I have gone out to President Trump to stop this, using all of these extremely important firsthand reports. And hopefully, I don't know, she just made this recording June 9th, so I don't know when it has stopped. Today is June 10th, okay? So here we go with Nurse Erin Marie Olzowski. Reporting from New York City. Thank you very much. Says Perspectives on the Pandemic, Episode 9. Oh, okay. The Epicenter Nurse, a conversation with Erin Marie Olzowski. I'm reading right from the video. Interviewed by John Kirby, The Press, and The Public Project. May 12th, 2020, New York City. Oh, this was May 12th, 2020. Protect against censorship. Please share, download, and replatform. I am doing
almost
that now.
Almost from the onset of the coronavirus epidemic in the United States, New York has been described as the epicenter of the outbreak, and Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, the epicenter of the epicenter.
Obviously, Elmhurst Hospital in Queens is right now the epicenter within the epicenter.
Elmhurst Hospital is the epicenter of the epicenter.
Elmhurst Hospital is really at the center of this crisis here in the city and in the country, with doctors desperately trying to keep up with the growing number of patients as supplies dwindle.
You see the black body bags? You say, what's in there? It's Elmhurst Hospital. Must be supplies. It's not supplies. It's people.
Also, from the beginning of the crisis, ventilators were described as essential life-saving equipment, initially in short supply.
You picked the 26,000 people who were going to die because you only sent 400 ventilators.
I knew that every person who needed a ventilator and didn't get one would die.
But why does New York, and Elmhurst in particular, appear to have been hit so much harder than other places in the United States? And were ventilators ever the right approach to treating COVID-19? Especially once we realized that 60 to 90% of those vented do not survive. The experience and observations of Nurse Erin Olzowski seem to offer some answers to these pressing questions, while simultaneously providing frontline information about a number of other hot-button topics, including the disproportionate number of COVID deaths among Americans of color, the distortions surrounding do not resuscitate orders, the disregard for personal protective equipment standards, and the clustering of COVID-positive with COVID-negative patients, which she witnessed again and again, and the tremendous amount of nosocomial or hospital-acquired infections that resulted. Perhaps most urgently of all, she speaks of the therapies and protocols employed in her home state that did work. Erin was brought from Florida by a service funded by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. She spent almost a month at Elmhurst. What she saw there compelled her to become a reporter and whistleblower alongside her already extensive nursing duties. made recordings, posted warnings on social media, and spoke through proxies about the nightmare conditions she witnessed. Erin was raised in Wisconsin and enlisted in the Army when she was 17, just before 9/11. She deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. Part of her duties involved overseeing aid disbursement and improvements to hospital facilities. While in country, she received the Army Commendation Medal for meritorious service and was wounded in combat. Erin eventually retired as a sergeant and became a civilian nurse in 2012. A mutual friend who was helping her make hidden camera recordings introduced us to Erin. After working a long shift at the hospital, she agreed to do an impromptu interview in her room at the Marriott Marquis overlooking Times Square. We encourage the viewer to leave aside their preconceptions about the nature of what is happening, to hear firsthand from an eyewitness who, at great personal expense and without political prejudice of any kind, now openly reports what she discovered in the hopes that the information will be put to good use to save lives. She began by telling us one of her most disturbing findings, that people who had repeatedly tested negative for COVID were being described as COVID confirmed.
Okay, so if you look close, I'm in my patient's chart. I am pulling up like their laboratory results. So if you look here, you'll see COVID-19 bioreference lab. Here are the test results. As you can see, 5/1/2020 at 17/16, not detected. You test for a second time, 5/4/2020 at 17/59, not detected. So both of those are negative. Scroll up to the top. This is my patient. They are on a vent, and they are being called COVID-19 confirmed. Droplet in contact and eye protection.
So this person is droplet in eye, COVID confirmed. Positive A, sick, not detected. Oh, pretty good.
While Erin was using her hidden camera to document another chart showing a patient with negative test results who nonetheless was labeled COVID confirmed, another travel nurse entered the room. They began to discuss what Erin was seeing.
This is bio reference?
Yeah, here.
So not detected here. That's presumptive. Now, they are detected for saying it's positive, not detected, but it's not detected. So
you said that they were vented immediately upon being brought in, is that?
Yeah, so the thing is they're coming in with difficulty breathing, and a lot of these patients are really coming in with anxiety because they're scared, and when I was back home, I was working in the ED. Out in the tent, and most people that were coming through with like symptoms of just, you know, anxiety, or, you know, they're worried and they're breathing fast and they get all nervous. So this is a lot of people are like coming in. Now, I'm not saying that some of them, you know, don't have COVID. Like there are people that come in and they really do need help, not to the extent of event, but they need help. But these other people, like this person who wasn't COVID multiple times, you know, and a lot of them are on either Medicaid or Medicare. They're poor. They're from, you know, a lower class. We're at a public hospital. They need the funding. So take them. They take them. And they tell them pretty much that if they don't get on the vent, then they're probably not going to survive. But the reality is, if they get on that vent, the likelihood of them walking out the hospital is slim to none.
Hey, can I ask you, like PEEP are they on, and is that being mandated or specified what the pressure is on the vent?
Here's the thing with this. So you don't have actual doctors that know critical care, ICU doctors on these floors. There's a dentist, and there are residents with these. So residents are essentially students, and they have no idea what they're doing. Like, I had to police, actually, today I had to police a resident. Because he wrote an order for me to run Versed, which is a medicine that you have to be very careful with because it can kill someone at like quadruple the speed of what you should be running at as a dose. And had I not known that, then I would have easily killed the patient. And it would have been okay under their COVID standards. So everything is kind of a wash. Nobody's held accountable for anything. And these people who are on vents are essentially being like, these residents are like practicing their skills on them. So they're practicing central lines. They're practicing like invasive procedures that are really unnecessary.
What is the percentage of Black, Latino, white? What's the racial composition?
Hispanic and Black for the majority.
And what's the age range? And what's the age range?
20-year-olds all the way up to 70, 80-year-olds. Very few 80-year-olds. But the majority of people, I would say, are in their 40s or 50s.
Wow. And what percentage of the people that are in there would you say actually have tested positive for COVID?
Half. Probably half.
But everyone is being treated as though?
The entire hospital is COVID. So half the hospital is not COVID, but they're on COVID floors.
So let me just ask you about nosocomial infection. So you're saying they're putting non-COVID or COVID rule out with definite COVID patients.
Yes.
So I was only wondering because, like, I was looking at, like, all the patient rooms and, like, this patient is in with, like, a non-COVID. I don't understand why they're doing that.
I know. There's four patients in a row here.
Yeah.
Non-COVID. And this is supposed to be the COVID.
Yeah.
Seventh floor, they shut it down.
That's right. I'm confused.
And then they're going to have non-COVID there.
Yeah.
This is going to be the only COVID, so they shouldn't put any non-COVID here.
Well, that's what they've been doing.
They're banking on the fact that they'll get it because they're already immunocompromised. So they're they'll put them in the same room, so there's double rooms. So you have a COVID with a non-COVID. They don't even care. We have enough rooms where they can be separated now because it's not as busy as it was, 4 weeks ago. But they don't care. They're just putting them together. I have that right now happening.
Like the guy over in.
Yeah. Two negatives.
And they end up positive. Like the guy over in 29, I had him upstairs because I was in CCU before it.
Yeah.
And he came in with a stroke.
I know, that's what 26 one was, a stroke.
And no COVID. And now he's got COVID and he's on a vent.
Oh, because we gave it to him there. She, I don't know how this ended up being COVID football. She literally came in with a broom and then she left like 5 minutes later. My patient had died of COVID and she didn't mop the floor. She was cleaning, getting prepared for my next patient and she didn't mop the
what?
Floor. I was like, that's the standard. I didn't think I had to tell her that.
Right. People don't know how to properly wear their PPE. Because let's go back to Ebola. Like, when Ebola was here, people took that very seriously. You have a nurse in the room in all the head-to-toe PPE. This is Ebola. This is. I'm going to compare it. And you have another nurse that's outside the room handing supplies, the clean nurse and the dirty nurse, right, going and when they're taking their outfit off, one nurse is unzipping the back so she can take it out, walking out.
Mm.
They're not doing that here. We're wearing, like, our scrubs. And then we have maybe, like, a net top. Our pants are exposed. They're wearing booties over their shoes, but the booties are going room to room to room. And then people will wear them to the hospital.
So there's massive spread just through the improper use of the PPE.
I mean, it's a no-brainer. It looks good. It looks good. It looks like you're super safe. But in reality, it's ridiculous. So you're going to go to, go room to room and maybe take that top off and a new top off. But the rest of you are still exposed.
But I mean, why are they doing this?
Suspected. And then there's like, principal hospital, does that mean like a nosocomial? Is that what that means?
Like, we have in the United States. We've had it for a while, a rapid test. It's 45 minutes. Do you have COVID, don't you? They're not doing the rapid test here.
You're not?
No.
Okay. In Elmhurst, you've never seen them?
Nope, they don't do it. Too expensive. They do 5 days. It's like 5 to 7 days turnaround. In the meantime, they admit them onto COVID units. So non-COVID, the rule outs are going to COVID units and waiting for the results. Even though we have a rapid result, which is 45 minutes, and they're not doing it. No. Not one.
When you say it's too expensive, I mean, isn't this all getting charged to the fund anyway? I mean, why not do it? Why not? Are you saying
that? I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense to me. I asked the doctor about it. How come you guys don't do the rapid test here?
It exists. It's just they don't have access to it. It's only the supply, so if you deposit, you get it first.
Oh, so money.
Most times it's money about everything, yes.
That's sad.
It's the reality.
I compare this hospital to a third world country. I've been in a third world country hospital in Iraq. The Iraq hospital is better than this one. And that says a lot. I've been there. I've been in both hospitals. And this is in the United States. And this hospital is treating low income mostly. People, and it almost makes me feel like they think these people are disposable, and they're not. They're people. You know, people are not disposable. You know, especially the ones that are struggling day in and day out, the hard workers. You know, like trying to reach that American dream, they're not given a chance because they're brought to this place where nobody cares.
And is there an understood financial incentive to diagnose COVID?
Yeah, of course. So in the hospital that I'm in right now, it's all COVID at this point. Every single floor is COVID, and they need it that way, obviously, for a reason, in my opinion. But a person cannot come to the floor unless they have a COVID diagnosis.
The reason, did they not want to cross-contaminate? Would that be the legitimate reason why you would create an all-COVID floor?
Here's why I will say no to that, is because they're admitting people for, quote, COVID rule-out. So this guy was probably admitted COVID rule-out, tested him. They saw that it came back negative. They probably already did something where they needed to now call him COVID, in the hope that if they're putting him on a COVID floor and there's nurses going room to room to room, he will get it, and then they'll be, you know, they'll be back when he does pass that he did have COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a charge. I mean, what makes you think they really want them to get COVID? Because it's
money. Money. I think it's at least $29,000 per patient. And then you have to think, you're also charging supplies, more supplies, more supplies. That's just like a bonus money.
But the residents aren't getting that, right? I mean, why?
Oh, that's the thing. And I actually went at it with a lot of residents already, and they're order followers. So there was a resident, and I have this on tape. I taped it because it was just so disgusting to me. A 37-year-old, which is my age, was not a DNR, is a full code. His family in depth discussed with the doctors that they want us to do everything we can to save him. And he came in talking. He was very terrified. He was just like, you know, totally alert, knew what was going on, and they convinced him to be on a vet. Now he's dead. But the doctor said, when I got onto shift, that if he codes, that we are not to resuscitate or try to save him. And we flipped.
I just asked him if he could put a DNR order on. He said no. That's up to the attending.
Okay.
So we're going to close him.
That's what I said, and I said no, we're not. I said yes, we are. We're obligated to.
So then I've got to say something to, like, it's our license. Unfortunately, you guys got to put it in order. Just
that's what I said. I said, I'm obligated.
Yeah.
What did she
say?
So then she's like, the higher up said. I said, I don't care what they said.
The higher up God? We don't have a God here making
decisions. I said, I don't care what they said.
So we're supposed to... He's not DNR, but we're treating it as DNR? Does his family know?
His family knows the situation. I think they called them and they told them. They were trying to do a two-way
communication.
All day, he spent like in the 80s after. It was this one on the forehead. It was this one. And they came down. When I changed it, I was like, oh, she was 90.
Yeah.
So they started playing around with the
oh, shoot, it's 90.
So he saw him perfect.
He changed the pulse off. His head, his finger, and he's like, oh, it's
90.
It's fine.
So what was that?
So that was, we were just getting on shift because we were starting the night shift at 7. And that was the nurse from the day shift saying pretty much we shouldn't code him if he's going to code. And then I turned my glasses off.
Why are we being told not to hold him, essentially? I mean, because I'm going to tell you right now, if he bottoms out, I'm jumping on his chest. Period. Point blank. It's going to happen. Because until that status is changed in the computer, that's what I'm obligated
yeah.
to do. Under
I mean,
my nursing license.
Because
you guys aren't going to back me up and protect me.
Well, Elmhurst does have a policy given, like a COVID policy, given
right.
the scarcity of
right.
dialysis
it can be,
and blood.
It can be a temp code. It can be whatever.
But it's not, there's not a, it's a difference. Normally the standard is whatever the family
right.
says, like you just do. So
right.
if they will say coding for about 5 years, like you just do that.
Right.
So they don't. It's a little bit different now because of the new policy in place.
Right.
In place, which is that you don't need full family, like you can just tell someone that it's medically futile, that we're not
right.
willing to just pour blood and resources into something that isn't, would be impossible to back.
Right.
But I, look, it's great, it's 37. I mean, it's
well,
so
they tried.
Well, our higher ups have agreed and our attendings agree that this is futile care at this point. He's not going to make it. I said, he doesn't have an epidural going, he doesn't have anything to sustain going. And I said, I asked, who decided this? And I said, can you put a comfort care order in then? No, we can't do that. Can you put a DNR order in? No, we can't do that. I said, so what's our plan? Well, he goes, well, he's dying. And I'm like, I understand that, but there needs to be an order indicating that either I'm doing compressions or I'm not doing compressions.
Well, I can say that we can all be in agreement that we will do it.
I will definitely. Because I'm going to jump on him.
Yeah. So will I. I'll go right with you. I don't care. That's what we need. That's what we're here for. I'm not
like, until they
game.
Change his status, that he is a DNR, and they can do a true physician consent if they talk to the family.
Yeah.
But until they change it, and I see it, he's a full code to me.
Well, we know when someone is, we're close. We'll pull the code card up and be ready. You know, we're ready. I had the epi ready. That's one of the first things we do. And she wouldn't let me get it. So this was that woman. And the entire time, and this was over his body, his alive body, and we're arguing, and she's laughing, she was smirking, and how this man died was the nurses arguing with the doctors over him that he was dying, and she's smirking the entire time. It was probably one of the worst experiences in my entire life. But all I can think about is that at least he knows that we were fighting for him. When he died. So. But this is my conversation after what happened. And the guy I told you about earlier that had pulled his tube out. He was up at that point. Like, he was on the same floor. He had pulled his... He was the one that they wanted to sedate. So, at that point, he was doing better where he could walk. This doctor put a diaper on him and told him to poop in his pants. So, after the code, I went to go check on him, and he's poop. He goes, I have poop in my pants. I was like, why do you have poop in your pants? And he said that because the doctor told him that he has to do that, and I just lost it. It was her.
This is wrong. It is straight up. It is wrong. And I am 37 years old. I have been in a hospital since I've been 16. Military hospitals that well.
I agree that there were parts of it that were wrong too.
Calling a patient a DNR when there's no order for it and telling us, like straight up telling us, you're not doing anything. That's wrong. If that was my brother or my father or anybody, I would be furious. And I guarantee you, if I called his family right now and told them what happened, they would be furious too.
I flipped. We were all crying. There's a lot of nurses that know that this is wrong, but they're afraid to like say anything publicly.
She said when I was talking to her, she said we're not always giving orders from the top down. And I was thinking that's the exact problem with everything. Where's it coming from? What's up? Are you guys really trying to kill everybody like everybody thinks
within our unit? It was a big fight, and ultimately the kid died with us over his body arguing about this.
So
over there.
Yeah. From the doctor, because the doctor would just write it up that we
No, because I don't know one.
I'm sorry. I'm not doing that.
There's a doctor that came upstairs that I had worked with prior. He was working in the ED, heard out what happened. He came into the room with me and told me that what I did was good. And that, so there are good doctors in here. You know, I guess the word traveled after this.
You mentioned earlier that this is a common occurrence where people come in able to speak and they just have low oxygen levels and they're put on a vent. So what's going on there?
I don't know. I honestly have no idea how they're assuming everybody is just the same. There's no individuality anymore. These residents, I think a lot of them are just stone cold. You know, there's no emotion. And they don't view people as people anymore. And it's really sad. Like, I came a little bit later, you know, after the big rush, but there was still a lot of people coming in. And a lot of us were just in shock. Within the first couple of days, you could see exactly what was going on.
The bigger problem with this whole scenario is when they intubate people which don't need it.
Yeah.
And it was very clear to me that they're just pushing it.
You almost feel like you are literally living in the Twilight Zone. And you feel like you're the only sane one in a bunch of insane people. And it's scary because these are the people that others are trusting to take care of them. And they're really doing the opposite. I'm to the point where I'm afraid that I'm going to start thinking that this is normal. I don't want to ever get to that point because they think that, like, the people I've worked with that are local nurses and doctors don't see anything wrong with this.
Really? I mean, they don't. No. Do they see with? Was it just like kind of a hard few months?
This has been like this, and from what I hear, like from, I mean, there are good nurses that work there too. Like, I have made good friends with a lot of the nurses that do work there. There's good people, but they're outnumbered.
So what happens? People come in, like this 37-year-old, and what was he complaining of or what was going on?
Respiratory distress. He didn't have COVID either. He did not have COVID.
And how do we know that?
I took care of him. I have the same type of results from his chart as I do with my other patient.
Well, like the day before intubation, he was fine on the air breather.
And then they intubated, and then he got home, and then they went in a pinch,
and now he's 37 years old and dead.
That's what I'm seeing. Like all these negative tests, and they're putting them on these vents, hopeful that they'll get it. They're being put on these COVID floors. It's murder. It straight up is. It is setting these people up for failure based on money.
Medicaid is who pays out, or who's paying this bonus of $29,000?
I believe it's Medicaid, Medicare. It's government money. But I don't know exactly where it's coming from, but I know that it is. But I know the orders are coming from the above, someone above. And everybody says that it's someone higher up. I'm like, good, call them. Like during that DNR when they're telling us, or the full code when they're telling us not to, you know, do CPR. I'm like, all right, call your higher ups then. Let's talk about it. And they wouldn't. Because they're all scared. Everybody's scared. And everybody's scared to stick up for themselves. And I've called a lot of doctors unethical to their face. And they deserve it.
I am a nurse. I'm an advocate for my patients. And
I totally agree.
Just wait. You were laughing and you thought it was funny. You were like smirking. You're being really rude to all of us. And I thought that was really good. It was really, yeah, you were. It was very disrespectful. And I don't think that you're going to be a very good doctor.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
But
I hope you learned something from this.
Was this the dentist or these are residents you're talking to?
This one was a fellow. Mm. She was a CCU fellow. She was a cardiac fellow.
What killed him? Did the vent kill him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're so sedated. He had probably 8 or 9 drips. It's all sedation. It's all sedation and paralytics. So you are asleep. It is essentially like you're under, you know, you're in surgery, you know, and they put you under like that for a good month straight. There's no way you can recover from something like that. You're brain dead if you do.
So can you list some of the drugs that they're put on the drips?
Yeah, there's propofol, fentanyl, Nimbex, Versed. Gosh. This is one of my patients was on this. Just one patient. So Nimbex, 100 milligrams. Precedex, 400 milligrams. Fentanyl, 2,500 micrograms. Heparin, 25,000 units. Versed, 50 milligrams. Levofed, 16,000. Neo, 50 milligrams. Propofol, 10 milligrams. Vasopressin, 100 units. This is one person, and they're all these drugs are running at the same time into that.
So in the case of this 37-year-old, he comes in complaining of some respiratory distress. Did he have blood oxygen?
Totally healthy guy, and he was statting, that's the oxygen saturation, and like 88, 89.
So a little low.
I mean, yeah, but people do that. You and I probably do that. We're not monitoring our oxygen, you know, all day long.
But he felt shortness of breath, so he came in.
Yes.
And what was the next step? What would have happened next?
He went to a step-down unit, among other...
What does that mean? Sorry.
It's just a unit where people aren't quite on the vent yet. And I say on the vent yet because I should call it step-up unit to the vent.
But, what's the phrase you used? COVID rule out.
So that's how they admit everyone to the floor that doesn't have a positive COVID immediately.
Okay, so he's put in the step down unit, which is a euphemism for step up unit.
Yeah.
And what happens to him there? What's going on there?
Oxygen. I wasn't in this unit. My friend was.
So just normal oxygen, nasal?
No, they'll do like a high pressure.
So what does that mean exactly? What does it look like?
It's pretty much like a force. It almost looks like a big stick nasal cannula, and you put it in your nose and it forces the pressure in. It can almost be like, you know, it's still causing your lungs to expand, right? But what they really need to be doing is like the non-rebreather mask, but they just skip it usually. They go right to the high pressure, so their lungs are already, you know.
So tell us what a non-rebreather mask is.
So that's just, there's a bag that is on the end of these masks. It's not forcing air down your lungs.
Okay.
It's more natural.
Okay.
You know, you can put 100% oxygen. That's what people need.
That, okay, so and that really is not the protocol. It's not the protocol to start people on that.
I mean, it should be, but it's not how they're doing it now.
I mean, in your prior experience dealing with people with low saturation, would that be what you would
do?
Oh,
yeah. That's what we were doing, you know, in my hometown.
And were you having better outcomes there?
Yeah, we didn't have this because we treated them properly, you know.
What would you say the kind of the case fatality rate was?
Zero. Yeah, by me, zero.
And what is the likelihood of coming out of the hospital you're in?
I'll tell you that the unit that I've been on, the only person that survived, ironically, is a guy who pulled his own tube out. Yeah.
So he woke up enough to be able to do that?
Yeah. He wanted out. He should have never been out in the first place. That's a whole other story.
So let's just keep going with this 37-year-old. So he's on the step-down unit, and he's being given semi-pressurized oxygen. It's not a rebreather mask. And then what happens to him?
They'll start treating them with medication, you know, that will...
And are they checking his saturation at this all the time? Does he have...
Yeah, he's on a continuous pulse ox. But, you know, the minute that he defects, like, they'll see, like, oh, no, he's at 87 now. Or, oh, look at this. Oh, he's going to need more help. And then they go tell them that they need more help, even if they don't. You know, it's ultimately what it comes down to is, like, people being just lazy and wanting to treat. They just want to treat, you know.
Is there any incentive to the – okay, you're saying that the incentive for the residents is kind of experimental almost.
They're order followers.
And
you know, like, they want to please. That's what they're doing. They want to please. And, like, the protocol of that hospital is to treat.
To treat invasively according to this protocol. And do we know where this protocol originates? I mean, because obviously the governor was talking about getting vents. Everyone was talking about getting vents. So this seems like this comes from very high up.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to tell somebody, the entire world, essentially, and especially the entire United States, and they're like, we need the vents. Like, if you tell people something enough, they're going to start believing it. So that's exactly what happened.
Tommy Wong Cuomo immediately thought 10 months ago that they need 30,000 vents. How do you just come up with a number? Cuomo's an idiot, too.
So our 37-year-old, what happens to him next? So they say, okay, it looks like he's 87, he needs more, and so is that the point at which they would intubate him?
Yeah, that's when he stepped up. So he stepped up to the ICU.
He steps up to
for
the ICU.
More care, right? They start off with a little bit of, like, muscle relaxer. And, you know, he's woozy. You have to remember there's no family with these patients. So they're alone and in hospital by themselves during a pandemic that they're terrified of already is likely what brought him in the first place, totally healthy otherwise. And then you have doctors. They think they're doctors, but they're residents. Technically, they're doctors with absolutely zero experience. I've had to teach residents several, like, nursing skills, telling them that they have a choice, you know, like, they could likely die from this or they can be saved by, you know, getting a tube that will help them breathe. They don't call it ventilator. We can give you a little help breathing. And that's it. Then they get the sedation and they go to sleep and that's it. They don't wake up. He's in a body bag.
And so the drugs have a deleterious effect on the body, on the brain, but is there something about the pressurization of the lungs that is also causing harm?
Yeah, they're having the pee, that's the pressure in his lungs, which is causing the barrel trauma of people. It's blowing people's lungs out. So when that happens, what do you got to do? Turn it up more. You know, you just keep...
Because the membrane expands so that you need, in order to fill them and deflate them, you need more pressure.
Yeah, you're going to have to Max, I mean, we have a guy right now who's maxed on everything. There's nothing more you can do. So then what? You just wait for them to die? I mean, there's nothing you can do.
Can you tell us what peep levels are they started on?
It depends. They're always usually, well, they'll start, there's some good ones. I can't say everybody's bad.
Mm-hmm.
There are some good doctors that will start them on M5, which people should be at both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But that doctor goes home, and the next doctor comes on shift and cranks it up. Then what? It's hard to go back down.
And what oxygen level are they put on?
It depends. I mean, as they start to deteriorate more and more, then the oxygen obviously is going up. The guy right now, I have him on 100%, and I will have to come in and, you know, give him a little bit more rush of 10 minutes of even more oxygen just to keep his stats up. I mean, that's what happens to people.
In your home state where you were treating people, what would the protocol be?
It's varied upon each individual.
Mm.
You know, but we definitely would never go immediately to, you know, you're going to need a vent.
You didn't feel pressure to diagnose people? There wasn't a pressure to diagnose people COVID?
Not at all. No. We're not a public hospital, too. That makes a huge difference. What I'm seeing is it's the public hospitals, and this is like in other states, too. If you look at all the hospitals, public that are needing money, but our hospital would just treat them based on the individual, you know, and they were using the hydroxychloroquine and the zinc and, you know, that protocol for sure.
At your hospital?
Oh, yeah.
And that seemed to work?
Yeah. We didn't have anybody that died. I think there was one patient that was admitted and went home like the day later. And I'm in a pretty big city.
And were these people who were elderly with comorbidities who were having good outcomes?
Yeah, actually, one guy the one guy that was admitted came from a nursing home, and he was obese, like severely obese.
He left after a day.
I think it was like a night, maybe two nights max.
And what do you remember? What he was treated with?
I didn't have him on the floor, but I can imagine he was treated with the protocol that we would prescribe the patient before they left the emergency room.
Which was?
With the hydroxychloroquine zinc.
Why do you think that's been demonized so much?
Because it's working and people wouldn't need sense. I don't know.
Only on 2 tonight, a Houston hospital is having success treating the coronavirus patients. In fact, its recovery rate is perfect.
Fascinating, isn't it?
To treat patients here, Dr. Veron is using an experimental drug protocol. It's a cocktail of vitamins, steroids, and blood thinners. Each patient also is getting hydroxychloroquine, the malaria drug touted by President Trump. The protocol is controversial because there hasn't been time for extensive testing, but Dr. Veron says it works.
We've treated over 40 plus patients with this treatment, and we haven't had a single complication.
So far, he says, none of his patients have died.
This is time of war. There's no time to double-blind anything. This is working. If it's working, I'm going to keep on doing it.
What we're finding clinically with our patients is that it really only works in conjunction with zinc. So the hydroxychloroquine opens the zinc channel, zinc goes into the cell, it then blocks the replication of the cellular machinery.
You're prescribing it, and it is working for COVID-19 patients.
Every patient I prescribed it to has been very, very ill, and within 8 to 12 hours, they were basically symptom-free. And so clinically,
wow.
I am seeing a resolution that mirrors what we saw in the French study and some of the other studies worldwide. But what I am seeing is that people are taking it alone by itself. It's not having efficacy.
Okay. What can you tell us about any confirmed COVID cases that you've seen? In both in your home state and here in New York, what have you noticed about them, and what do their stats look like?
The real confirmed COVIDs that come in, you immediately know that they're COVID because they cannot, like, they can't breathe. They literally can't breathe. So they do need that non-breather mask, or their SAC will, like, quickly drop to, you know, 60, 70. If you want to be at around, you know, 90 to 100.
So they can't talk either.
Some of them can talk. A lot of this is anxiety. But the problem with this is they were being told, the public has been told to self-quarantine, right?
Mm.
Stay home. That's a problem because these people could be getting early treatment.
There's clinical trials emerging that appears to show that it decreases severity early in the game, before you end up hospitalized, before you end up on a ventilator.
And they're not because they were told to stay home. So now they're getting really, really sick, and they come in on an emergency status. They waited too long. If they didn't wait too long, they're easily treatable.
And easily treatable, you feel, with some of these treatments?
Yeah,
like 100%. Zinc and hydroxychloroquine and, you know,
It's working. I mean, it's been proven to work. There's a doctor, I think, in Texas that, you know, using that protocol and a shot in the butt, you know, of antibiotic shot. I don't know exactly which one she was using, and she's successfully treating. And she was saying that the pharmacist now is calling her every time that she prescribes, you know, the hydroxychloroquine, and asking what the diagnosis was of the patients in order to give it to them. Like, that's a doctor-patient relationship. So the pharmacist, I guess, was told to do this. And, you know, in New York, the governor said, you know, pretty much put a ban on it. So why? Why? What made him, you know, a medical professional now to make these decisions and intrude on the doctor-patient relationship? I think I know.
Mm.
You know, I've seen it. They want a vent. He wants to be right. They requested all these vents. They want to use them.
As part of the same executive order that granted hospitals near-blanket immunity from malpractice litigation during the epidemic, Governor Cuomo singled out hydroxychloroquine as the one drug that could not be used as an off-label therapy for COVID-19. Except as a part of approved studies. The order was issued ostensibly to prevent hoarding so that those who take this decades-old, inexpensive treatment with a long safety record for approved conditions like lupus would have access to it. He later amended the order to allow hydroxychloroquine use in later-stage patients in hospitals, but not in early outpatient treatment. Both hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine had shown efficacy in the prior SARS coronavirus epidemic, and studies in France and other countries had already shown its effectiveness for COVID-19. But instead of making research and production of a promising therapy a priority so that there wouldn't be shortages, vents became the near exclusive focus, along with the search for a vaccine. This has been true even of President Trump, who, despite his public cheering for hydroxychloroquine, has not made it the focus of warp speed funding and testing. A number of U.S. studies have shown the promise of hydroxychloroquine-based therapies, most recently a Yale University study focused on early treatment. And in what may be the most scandalous retraction in recent memory, a Lancet paper that purported to show hydroxychloroquine alone or with other therapies was in fact dangerous has been shown to be based on fraudulent data. Aaron's Hope Hospital System confirmed in a phone conversation with respect to the pandemic that they had used a protocol involving hydroxychloroquine and zinc to great effect.
In your view, this should be an individually decided doctor-patient choice.
Everything should be that. I mean, there is no reason that any government should get in between a doctor-patient. That's none of their business. You know, if anything is HIPAA protected, it should be that. I mean, when you think about it, it's sickening. The same reason they won't use, like, other treatments that are successful around the world. And I had a conversation with a doctor about this.
Are you guys doing, like, different sorts of, like, treatments? Because I know, like,
nothing works.
They have... Yeah, but, I mean, there's, you know, they're coming out with different things are in the testing
phase. It's the same thing they come with a track when they've got two more people than actually see.
Uh-huh.
So that's one.
And he said that
they don't work anyway. And I told him, well, obviously what you guys have going on here isn't working. So what's the harm in trying?
I don't expect any of these people to survive. 90% of them will die.
I mean, it's just maintaining. So I figured if it's assumed, they're going to die anyway.
Yeah.
Just try not throw a few.
Well, it's, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. That was an issue there, and whether this is the first thing that they're dying anyway or not.
But if you could find a cure.
Well,
yeah, I mean,
there's
like
no cure. So there's no antiviral therapy. The only way to do it is cure. But there's
or
no
treatment,
antiviral.
I should say. Rephrase.
You
treatment.
You could treat it, but you know, you have to have some scientific basis for whether these things are working or not. If they're strong, everything gets done. You could make them worse.
Mm-hmm.
So,
worse than death.
Well, we said 90%, maybe that 10% maybe get you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if there's no basis for it working, I mean, you wouldn't just fight and just go.
I would.
Oh, I might.
It could save my life. Yeah, hell yeah.
So, with these...
That was the doctor she was talking to.
They present by not really being able to breathe. Maybe they've, as you say, they've probably waited too long. They're not able to breathe. And some of that's anxiety. And what else? So what else do they, how else do they present?
So their mom, if you look at their x-rays, you can immediately see that these patients are affected by COVID because they're white. Their lungs are white. And the secretions are really, really thick, mucusy, and white. And that's what the photo or the x-ray of these lungs look like.
And what does a white lung look mean? What is that? Is that just, is that mucus?
Yeah,
in the lung?
It's coated. It's almost like their lungs are coated.
So that makes it hard to obviously transfer oxygen into the bloodstream. And so they've got very mucusy lungs. And how do you deal with that? Is that what hydroxychloroquine and zinc do? Or?
I mean, those treatments are for beginning stages.
Mm.
Like, once you get to the stage where your lungs are looking like that and you're having a lot of trouble breathing, there are proven treatments that have passed like three trials in Asia through Dr. Chang. He's a U.S. board certified physician. Is this like extremely high dose IV vitamin C? He's successfully treating people with that. And what that's doing is it's giving your body, especially your lungs, like the power, the antioxidant power to kick it out while you can be getting IV antibiotics to be treating this and getting rid of it.
That's vitamin C.
Nothing to do with it here.
They don't want to have anything to do with vitamin C. In New York City.
Yeah. Have you done the high dose IV vitamin C that's successful in Asia?
There's no.
Again, it's the doctor.
Dr. Chang. She was the one that it went through that high dose. I'm talking super high dose IV vitamin C. That's super antioxidant. Helps your body fight that. It passed three trials. And it's being effective. It's just weird how, like, everybody shuts it down immediately.
Vitamin C has been around for a very long time.
Oh, that's weird, because I take it daily. And I'm sick.
You're not getting sick. I don't think it's from vitamin C.
So how quickly does, so if you have a COVID and a COVID rollout or a non-COVID right next to each other on vents, will the COVID patient die more quickly than the non-COVID patient?
If they're on vents, no. They're both the same at that point. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So even though the COVID patient with the, you know, presenting with a very mucousy lung, I mean, are their lungs filled or they're just coated?
Yeah. I shouldn't say that. I'll take that back. It really depends on the person, how healthy they were before.
Mm-hmm.
That really determines how long that they're going to be able to sustain the paralytics and, you know, sedation and multiple different procedures. Even when you're, like, sleeping or you're, like, you know, knocked out, sedated, and they're putting you through, like, these central lines that they're putting in and trachs, they're doing trachs, even though they're practicing.
your body knows what's going on. It's still going through trauma. It's very traumatic, even when you're under. That's why surgery takes a while to recover from, because you'll feel it for, you know, how long you feel that, if you've ever had a surgery. And so they're putting their bodies, they're, you know, through horrible things, and that's adding more stress. It's killing them. Yeah. So the guy that pulled out his tube is really unique, because I saw him from the minute he got to our unit. I didn't agree with him coming to the ICU. But he was admitted with hyperglycemia, which is high blood glucose, at like 700. So it was pretty high. And learned later that it was high because they were treating him with a lot of different psych drugs, and that increases it. It was the treatment that 700. And when you have a blood glucose that high, you're automatically going to have altered mental status. So now they called him crazy. Okay? So he's admitted to the ICU, and everyone's like, well, why is he here? Because he was acting, you know, he was acting out. He didn't know where he was. He was confused. And I went in there, and he wasn't my patient, but, you know, we help each other. And I went in there, and I tried to talk to him, calm him down. Okay, he's like, I just want to get out of here. I want to get out of here. He has soft restraints on, so they restrain everybody. We have soft restraints on all of our patients, the majority of them, for sure, which is, I think, is crazy. But it goes with the territory, because everybody's really lazy, and it's easier to just treat them with drugs or tie them to their bed. So he was tied up. Obviously, what is that going to do? It's going to make, you're tied up in a hospital. You don't have any family. What do you think? You're gonna freak out. So he was. His oxygen was sitting at, you know, 88, you know, 87. Doctor comes in. I should say fellow comes in. And she says that if you can't get your breathing under control, we're going to have to put a tube in you to help you with that. And I go, what? I'm like, he doesn't need a tube down his throat. Like, he doesn't need a vent. She goes, well, yeah, he's de-statting. And I said, no. Like, absolutely not. He does not need that. We need to get his blood sugar under control, and he will be fine, and maybe not tied to this bed. And she goes, yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll just monitor him. And this was, I was working night shift. This was probably around 6 a.m. At 6:45, we had a code down the hall. The code passed. To do all that, got out of there. I come back for a shift, and guess what? The guy is on a vent. I was so upset. They did it, I guess the nurses that took over said they did it literally as I left.
So I come back in the morning, he's on a vent. And yep. I'm like, you have to be kidding me. He did not need a vent.
They waited for you to leave.
They did. We literally, that was the morning we coded 28 for 3 minutes. That we know sooner took the vent out of that room, cleaned it, and put it in here.
Yeah.
A tube tube.
Yeah, they took his vent.
After he died, what happened on him?
So they waited until I left, because they know how I feel about this stuff.
Same thing with that night. They didn't need to debate him. He was progressing. I don't know what happened after. We tried bypass, and then they brought him here, and I thought, well, crossing my fingers.
See, you know, no one survived. He did. He was the only one that I got.
That's what happened with him.
But he pulled out his tube out and said he has a chance again.
Oh, he did?
He extubated himself.
Oh, he did? I didn't know that. I thought he was extubated.
And how did he wake up?
Turns out that he did drugs.
So he was resistant.
He was.
Fentanyl.
All of this stuff that we give normal people didn't cut it for him. So he ended up. Yeah. I'm like, you just saved your own life, you know? That's crazy. Don't put that on. But I mean, it did. You know, it's sad. So they pulled it out, and they're like, oh, you know, so-and-so's extubated. And I'm like, no way. They don't extubate anybody. I'm like, that's so weird. And here it turns out he extubated himself. And now, he's fine. He's home now. This was just a couple days ago. But you know, what's sad is that he thinks he saved his life.
You know what I mean? So he's like, you saved me. And I couldn't, you know, I had the heart to be like, no, man, you saved yourself. You have, like, nine lives. Because had he not pulled that out, he would definitely be dead. For sure. They don't excavate anyone.
Here's the problem. Another syndication here. Has been discharged or successfully excavated.
I asked the nursing supervisor for a sitter for the guy that pulled the tube out, because when they're waking up, they can be extra, I should say, where they need a little bit of extra attention. And I asked her for a sitter, and she told me that I didn't utilize all my resources first, which was Hellbell, all the psych drugs to, like, chemically, you know, put him to bed.
Your Florida hospital was literally having to furlough people?
Yeah. What was happening is, obviously, they shut down all elective procedures. But they were also waiting for the wave. They called it the wave. So we were preparing, and we were in tiers based on our experience. So we were tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. And I was tier one because I have the, you know, military trauma experience, ICU experience, so on and so forth. So I was working, you know, throughout the hospital, training in other units, cross-training. Ultimately, it was to get hours. You know?
It was what?
It was to get hours.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this
right.
is what the hospitals were doing. They're like, okay, we're going to give our employees hours this way to cross-train them for when the wave hits. And then that wave would get pushed back another week, and then they get pushed back another week. And the units that we were floating to, like, cross-training, they're like, what are you doing here? We don't need you. So I felt like I was wasting my time and taking up other people's time that were trying to get hours, too. And this opportunity presented itself, and I took it.
Do you think that the reason you never got a COVID wave in Florida was because of any of this lockdown? Or, I mean, what? I mean, I know you're not an epidemiologist,
no,
but what do you think was
so
going on?
I live right by, and that was, like, worldwide news. People were at the beach. I was one of those people at the beach with my kids. Sunlight, it's vitamin D, it's good for your immunity, fresh air. Salt water, all these things are really good for anyone's, you know, immune system. You have to be out. Mental health, you know, we were all at the beach.
And so people, if there was a lot of transmission going on.
Wouldn't you think our hospitals would be flooded? They're not. I'm right at the beach. I'm right by the beach. Didn't happen.
Because the lockdowns happened after all that. And
it was spring break. You know, the beaches were packed. I mean, there's people from all over the world. Like, tons of New Yorkers live by us.
I'm asking you to speculate here, because you really feel there is something, a new disease called COVID-19, do you feel that that's the case, or do you think that this is, I mean, I know there's a lot of mislabeling, and I know all that, and there really is something new, right? Okay. And why do you think it, you know, places like New York got, well, okay, we can see that what you were describing at Elmhurst was that they were packing people in together. And so that would cause spread. But why do you think a place like New York got hit so much harder than other places?
I thought about that already. What I found is that before this happened, because it didn't make sense to me. I'm like, I'm sitting at home. I'm waiting for work. I'm stressing out. A lot of my friends are doing the same. So I'm, like, digging. I'm like, why is New York, like, what is it because there's that many people crunched in together? But ultimately, what I found is that the hospitals here were already struggling. I think they've shut down, like, multiple hospitals because they couldn't afford to keep them open. So
that made sense to me, even though I didn't want it to make sense. You know, like, there's really no other rhyme or reason, because, like...
Do you think we really do have many more cases, regardless of whether or not, you know, people went to the hospital?
I think they're forced cases. I mean, sure, people are coming in with COVID, whatever that may be. It is something, but not everyone. But they're admitting these people. That's the difference between New York hospitals or these, you know, Michigan, you know, the states that were, you know, hit the hardest, quote. They're admitting these patients as possible COVID. Calling it COVID.
Or rule out COVID.
Rule out COVID when they maybe just had a little congestion.
If there's something you would want to tell everyone in the country and everywhere else, what one last thing, what would it be?
I would say this as and this is the one thing that I've had a struggle with, is if someone like me or anybody is trying to tell you something that might go against your belief, like, just listen, you know, like, really just take it in, and instead of jumping on it, like, think on it for a night or a day, like, look into it and ask people about it. Like, not every nurse is going to have the same experience. A med-surg nurse as before, even in my own hospital, has not had the same experience as the ICU nurses have. And once I sit down and explain it to them, it all makes sense. They're like, yeah, that makes sense. We see that. You know, so, like, just think about it, you know, and be respectful, and, like, no one wants to put themselves in a situation like this, you know, and it's really hard, and this is the reason that a lot more people and nurses are afraid, because people are so quick to, you know, defend something that they don't really understand.
What are you referring to in particular, like, this protocol, or what?
Like I referred to earlier, if you tell people, like, something enough over and over, like, the media was telling people, you know, vents, and then you say, as a nurse, no vents, you know, it's not a good position to be in, because I'm going against what the government says. But does the government really have everybody's best interest in mind? You know, are they thinking of, you know, the 57-year-old grandma that, you know, didn't have to die, or the 37-year-old that was totally fine when he walked in the emergency room and he didn't have to die? You know, are they thinking about, you know, maybe the guy that had a drug problem that didn't have to be vented but saved his own life? I don't have anything to gain. I have everything to lose by sharing what I'm sharing right now.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's important that these families get closure, and I hope that someday she'll be able to, you know, hold them accountable for what they did.
A few days after we recorded this interview, Erin began to feel that her time at Elmhurst was drawing to a close. Her vocal questioning of hospital procedure and her efforts to get the word out on social media were getting noticed. She made this recording on what ended up being her last day at the hospital.
I've been taking care of a patient for like a week right now. Who's this nice I call them? And she's been doing great.
Yeah, as Trey put it, and he's been doing great. He's been talking, like, or communicating with me, telling me, like, laughing at my jokes, and talked to his kids on FaceTime a couple days ago. And I told him that. I told his kids that he was doing fine. And he was. Today, I was giving him, and they came in, and they told me that I need to leave the room, and I have to give report to somebody else. They took me from that unit, and they put me in the emergency room, and they don't need me there, but they put me there, and I'm not even there, like, 20 minutes. I'm not even there 20 minutes, and I hear a code being called in my room that I was just left. And it's him. And he was fine. He was fine. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense. Like, why would they take me out of his room and put me in the ED? And then not 20 minutes later, he's dead. It doesn't make sense. Like, did they kill him? He was my one patient that was going to live. He shouldn't have died. I don't know what they did to him. Something's not right.
Later heard that AmbuBag resuscitation was improperly performed by a resident while her patient had a blocked tract. That's what she later heard. In response to our query, a spokesman for Medicare, Medicaid, said compensation for hospitals varies by state. As of broadcast, New York State has not responded to our inquiry. The producers have reached out to Elmhurst Hospital for comment. Any response they receive will be posted in the description below the video. Despite mounting evidence that hydroxychloroquine in combination with other therapies is especially effective in the early stages of symptomatic COVID-19 cases, the policy in New York State remains to limit its use to clinical trials in patients who are critically ill. I'm reading off the screen. Oh, that's it. Okay. Thank you very much for paying attention to that. I want everybody to go to my blog now. It is called tinyurl.com/wakeup515. And I'm going to go there now and open it and tell you what you can expect to find. That, even though it was uploaded to that video channel, and I'll, you know, the video will be below the screen as well, so you can see the video yourself. In June, I believe it was June 9th, the interview was May 22nd, and the final interview, I believe, I'm not sure what date that was. However, let me go to Wake Up 515. I'm on a different blog of mine. I believe it would be here, and tell you what you can expect to find there. I have several blogs on since the coronavirus started. One in particular, being a New Yorker, is what I, you know, the first video that I have here is basically talking about all the different nurses who are speaking out and how none of the families can get in to see their relatives, and this is how they are pulling off the murder of these patients. And as she was showing you at the beginning, or as you heard at the beginning of this recording, people who were dying of COVID did not have COVID. And she just stated at the very end of this video that the one patient who would have lived, he too died. So So that means 100% of her patients died. The one person who got away probably was not her patient, but she had he unplugged himself and left. Basically, he saved his own life, although he credits them. In fact, she was saying he saved his own life. So we go through several nurses. The nurse who was Erin Marie, who you just heard, her friend reported about this before May 8th, because this blog was made on May 8th. Okay, so she then herself spoke out on May 22nd, and I'm not even seeing her speak out till June 9th. Okay, and then we go, the next thing on the blog is a woman from the Dominican Republic leaving a message for a loved one in Spanish from a hospital in New York City. I found this in a comment stream on Nurse Erin Marie's page, and translated this recording says, "Do you know what they did? They injected all these poor sick people. I'm the only one left. I swear, I love you so much. I saw with my own eyes. They brought me to this damn hospital so they can inject me and I die. Don't be afraid, but they injected me too. But God will make them pay." So that was a recording in Spanish from a woman from the Dominican Republic, which I had translated by a person from the Dominican Republic. Okay, the next is Nicole Siratek, who's a nurse in a New York City hospital. She gives a very long video that has been taken down so many times. It was her recording, and then an article was written that salvaged her recording, and I sent that to Donald Trump through Twitter. And the mayor is went door-to-door in Brooklyn in three zip codes and forced vaccinated or fined $1,000 or jailed people. So I knew I had nobody to turn to there. Our governor is very pro COVID vaccine, and he's also approved a meningitis vaccine that even the CDC recommended mandate here for school children in New York. So I knew that I had nobody to talk to there. So I reached out to Donald Trump, even though I have written 21 letters to him in 2017 about vaccination and about the horrid results therefrom. I didn't even talk to him about autism, even though it's 1 in 32, according to Dr. Batar, according to the CDC. I didn't talk to him about that because he knows about vaccine-induced autism. He spoke about it in a Republican debate, but I did talk to him about our disgraceful infant mortality rate post-vaccination at the 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months, which is when they are given 5 to 7 shots at once, and they're dying, needless to say. And we have the worst record in the developed world on vaccination. Even if you combine all other countries, we are greater than them combined, okay, in infant mortality. And day of birth mentality, we're number one. We're number one. That's because we give two shots, the vitamin K shot, which comes with a black box warning, and the hepatitis B shot, which is intended for prostitutes and drug addicts. And because they rejected it, they are giving it to newborns. And when asked why, the response was, because we can. Yeah. So also, children who are autistic, if they had the hepatitis B, which is still optional, even though they may slip it in while washing or weighing the child, the newborn. They may do this against your will, and it has happened time and again. A child who's received the hepatitis B vaccine is 10 times more likely to be autistic. Okay, well, then after Nurse Nicole Sirotek, who made a very compelling video, and the article that I sent with that video in it to Donald Trump on Twitter. That's how I, the only way I can get a message to him, because I haven't been able, even going directly to the White House with a letter to him, not in an envelope, just a sheet of paper with text on it, they would not accept it. So I have had very tough time getting through to him. So I've decided, since he's on Twitter, I'll tweet him. And many, many people shared it. You will see possibly one like or one share on my blog. But since that initial posting, a multitude of people have shared that to make sure he got the message that people are not dying of COVID in New York City hospitals. They're being murdered. So then we have multiple doctors on the front lines in New York City speaking out, and that's fantastic to hear. Plus experts not in New York City. Then we have emergency room doctors revealing disturbing COVID truths. The media won't tell you, a series of ER doctors. And then we have funeral directors in New York City saying it is impossible that all deaths are due to COVID-19. Well, of course it's impossible. So I have a lot of other things. Forensic doctor destroys media lies, and not a single COVID-19 test is FDA approved. Oh, the president of Tanzania, my favorite individual alive at this moment, not only tested fruit and animals for COVID-19, and they came up positive, okay, fruit. And he did that as a scientist to see what would happen. Well, he found, yeah, I mean, you can say he was a skeptic to do it, but he's also coming from a scientific perspective. And then he banned recently all face masks. And there are a host of reasons to do that. I could do a whole show on why you shouldn't wear a face mask. So his video is there as well. And a coronavirus press conference with the Department of Public Health. A senator and doctor quoted as saying a hospital is getting paid more to label cause of death as coronavirus. So a senator and doctor, he's both, is outing that. Then the World Health Organization and the Queen of England announcing children will be removed from homes. And Dr. Sherry Tenpenny calling COVID-19 the biggest scam ever. Dr. Judy Mikovits thoroughly explains her position, which is a very, very good interview. And then Dr. Rashid Batar, a U.S. military veteran and doctor, sums it up very well. I would follow him for sure. Then I have a link. It says save us from COVID-19 vaccines. I interviewed a pharmacist about the components of the COVID-19 vaccine. And basically, you can expect that this vaccine will alter your DNA and perpetually alter it. Okay. Then I have some more critical information. This says it is critical that you share this information. I don't even know which link this is. Here, let me open it and find out what this critical, it's probably removed by now, you know, everything worth its salt is. Amazing Polly is doing amazing work, talking about the global public health mafia, and she really does her research. What a gift she is. Now I think I have to click backwards to okay. So what else you will find on this blog is group prayer toward group hug every evening at 6 p.m. A woman who has a program called You Are Free TV, and others are calling for wherever you are at 6 p.m., country, for your family, for the world, say a prayer for humanity, basically. So I'm saying it's a group prayer towards a group hug every evening at 6. But when they first announced COVID, I immediately said, don't take the vaccine. They hadn't even talked about the vaccine, but I knew it was coming. Boy, do I know that. If I know nothing else, there's a vaccine, okay? And the next thing I wrote was group hug, because we're all being told to stay apart from one another. So I posted on Facebook, group hug, and everybody loved it and shared it. And, yeah, to be told not, and there are so many benefits to hugging and to shaking hands and to patting someone on the back. There are health benefits to these interactions, not just being able to stand close to someone, but actually physically embracing them or shaking their hand or patting them on the back. And I have a video about, Dr. Caldwell. Oh, he did a great job. I interviewed him on RBN last week or the week before, and he really goes into every aspect of this. And he is a very famous doctor for curing cancer, basically. He can't say cure, so 99% recovery. How about that? Can't say 100%. So many things you can't say. So he's known for helping people. How about that? And anyway, he does break down every aspect of this vaccine, and you can find that at tinyurl Caldwell on COVID. And Caldwell is pronounced cold, Coldwell. So tinyurl.com/Caldwell on COVID. Okay. I would highly recommend you listen to that. And let's see what else. Oh, yes. Sweden did not lock down the Swedish people, and they are doing very well. They were doing very well almost immediately. How do you like that? We're still on lockdown. People are still running around with masks on. And then I list the New York State COVID-19 rules as of May 11th. The rules, you know, the whole thing is ever evolving. There is a very funny article written for Able Danger about this. And then a woman read this on a video that went completely viral about the ever-changing criteria, rules, and regulations pertaining to COVID. So that was nice to get something that you could enjoy the irony of anyway. And then the U.S. government stimulus checks may be applied for by May 13th, 2020. A friend of mine really went out of her way to say, listen, if you are suffering, you don't have to. If you haven't gotten your stimulus checks, by all means, apply for them. And you can find that interview at, and there may be more coming out, and certainly we shouldn't have to be suffering economically. Also, not that the stimulus check is going to solve all your problems, but if it's already been allocated for this purpose, and you're hungry, for goodness sake, take action. and you will find my interview with Roxy Lopez. It says Paul Turner and Roxy Lopez. She was the second interview, and I believe it starts at 1 hour and 15 minutes into that interview at tinyurl.com/6, okay? tinyurl.com/6-feet-apart. So just scroll down to Paul Turner and Roxy Lopez's interview and go to an hour and 15 minutes to find out all the good information she provides to ensure that every citizen receives a check. It was very conscientious of her. And let's see what else. So that's it for that one blog. I also have other blogs. I mean, you know what? I'm not even sure. Hold on. Let's see. I'm not sure that I have a tiny URL for this blog. I think I gave you the tinyurl.com/wakeup515 for the Sobering Beyond Word blog, which also pertains to COVID. I'm not sure that I made a tiny URL for that blog. Yeah, this one, the next one is wakeup515. So, okay, go to brightfuture83.wordpress.com. brightfuture83.wordpress.com. And scroll down to the title of this particular blog, which reads New York City, it'll say NYC, doctors, nurses, funeral directors are speaking out to save patients. So it turns out I never made a tiny URL for this one. But it's not far from the top. The only update above this is Eternal Vigilance Oppose HR 6666. Well, 6666 is now part of HR 6800, which has already passed the House of Representatives in the United States of America. So I just did a show about that, also with Paul Turner. And it's very, I read the entire text of that pertains to health within HR 6800. And it is talking about tracking, about testing, tracking, okay, wait, testing, tracing, tracking. Right, testing, tracing, tracking. And I think it even gets into removing people from their homes. Ammon Bundy did a remarkable production that I may just play for you right now. Go to tinyurl.com/HR6666 to hear this. It is disturbing beyond word, but one must buckle down, listen to what he has to say, and understand that when they're coming into your home, they're coming for your kids. The Queen made that. You know, the WHO's, the World Health Organization said it, the Queen said it, but she was quite specific about it being the children who will be removed. And here is Ammon Bundy. You know, maybe I should play the Queen's one too. Oh boy. Well, I tell you what, just go visit brightfuture83.wordpress.com. Realize that we have an immense problem on our hands. And the mother load of all the information leading up to all these other blogs I've mentioned is tinyurl.com/fearvirus. That'll give you the whole history of COVID-19. Okay, goodbye for now. Thank you for paying attention and listening to Nurse Erin Marie.